Welcome to Ever Beyond on Free Thinking Radio. Be prepared to leave your belief systems behind as we go beyond teachers, beyond gurus, beyond duality, ever beyond. Good evening and welcome to Ever Beyond. Slight technical hitch. I wish that button would stay in. so we've just been talking to ourselves and having... It was a kind of mute button. So we're going to roll all that back. And today I'm talking with Dave Patrick, who's the editor of the book The View Beyond, with various essays and vignettes dedicated to the connection between Arthur Conan Doyle and Francis Bacon. Well, it's mainly about Francis Bacon, but Conan Doyle exists in that little link there. And you're previously an author of a book called The View by... That was an edited book, was it?
That's correct, Jeremy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So... Yeah. I'll let you explain these things because I'm obviously incredibly confused about all this stuff. So you can set me straight. Let's talk about The View and welcome to Dave Patrick. Good evening.
Okay. Good evening. Thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me here, Jeremy.
That's right.
This wonderful studio setup you have.
Yes. It's...
The View came out in 2009. It was in honour of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It's his 150th. Anniversary of his birth. He was born in Edinburgh 22nd of May 1859, and that was an idea that kind of crept up in me for some time, and I guess we can go back and talk about that in a bit more detail, but I know the focus for this evening is probably more on Sir Francis Bacon, although the two, as I'll explain, kind of ended up being a very kind of interwoven story in terms of my own kind of life as well. But the Bacon part of the story started in February 2010, just last year, when my publisher, Colm Hayward of Polair Publishing, both books, by the way, are published by Polair Publishing, a small London-based company.
Can you spell that?
P-O-L-A-I-R.
Oh. There goes our microphone. Wait a minute. Oh, yeah, this is so professional. Look at this. This is the pinnacle of professionalism. The microphone held on by gaffer tape everything's falling down now. So, Polair, how do you spell that?
P-O-L-A-I-R. And it was actually taken from a group in France called the Polair Brotherhood, and they spelt the name with an E in the end. And there's a connection with the Polair Brotherhood, which is connected into Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and that whole story. Mm. So we can come to that in a little while, if you like.
Okay. That's good.
Okay, so, as I said, Colm came back to me in February 2010 and said, we'd like to do a follow-up on Sir Francis Bacon. And I said, yeah, I'd love to, but... Actually, who is Sir Francis Bacon? Because I hadn't really heard of him before.
Oh.
And he kind of explained that he was an Elizabethan genius, etc. And explained, a number of strands to him. And I said, oh, well, that sounds like a really interesting project. So I think, as you said, Jeremy, this is an edited book, just like the previous one, The View.
Mm.
Slightly different in conception, because with The View... I really didn't have time to write a whole book on my own, so I came up with this idea, or I was guided to come up with this idea, to use Conan Doyle's book, The Vital Message, as a theme. Now, The Vital Message was a book that came out in 1919, after the First World War, and it followed on from a book called The New Revelation in 1918, which is very much to do with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle kind of coming out about... the truth and the proof of the afterlife and his whole belief in spiritualism and so forth, and the kind of stuff he actually got a very bad press about in the last decade or so of his life. before he died in 1930. And I'd always felt that he'd had a bit of a bad press around that. So, as I said, having come up with the idea of using the vital message as a theme, I then went out to my network and asked people to contribute what their vital message would be for these times. I didn't mention anything about spiritualism or whatever. I mean, all I said was that I would like you to do this to honour Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's 150th, and all I ask is that you write from the heart. And literally within a day, I knew that I was onto a winner in terms of the way the project sort of panned out, because this was October 2008. I wanted to have this book published for May 2009. Now, rationally, you'd have said, well, there's no way you're going to get a book published in that time. I had no publisher at the time either. And when I put the invite out to my network, and one of the people I spoke to was Alexander Laszlo, and Alexander might actually be listening in tonight from Budapest, if he is. Hi there, Alexander. And he came back and said, what a great idea. He was up for it. Another Californian, because Alexander's based in California, another Californian colleague in San Francisco Bay Area, Verna Ali, came back and said, yeah, great idea. Here's some unpublished material I think will fit the bill. And everything just kind of snowballed from there. Do you want me to actually explain a bit more about Conan Doyle just now as I lead in, or do you want me to leap forward to Francis Bacon?
Well, let's just talk about Conan Doyle, because most people, let's just kind of link him in with what everybody knows that Conan Doyle wrote the Sherlock Holmes mysteries.
Well, most people know the connection there. I mean, everybody's heard of Sherlock Holmes, yes, but they haven't necessarily heard of Conan Doyle.
Yeah.
And not everybody is actually aware that he wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories, because Sherlock Holmes has actually taken on almost a life of his own. In fact, there's a fascinating story from the research that I did, where I stayed in a farmhouse near Minstead, where Conan Doyle and his second wife were reburied.
Minstead is in Scotland?
Sorry, Minstead is in the New Forest in England,
south
of England. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a whole story that would take the whole evening to describe about why he was reinterred in Minstead and so forth. But anyway, I stayed in a farmhouse nearby, bed and breakfast, and the woman there showed me a clipping from a local paper, and it was quite interesting because it actually said that Sherlock Holmes was the creator of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. So, and I thought, well, that's interesting, and I actually mentioned that in the View, you know, in terms of how people pick up information. You know, there was more, you know, there's more sort of validity in a lot of people's minds about Sherlock Holmes being a real person when actually he was a fictional character.
There was, and there may still be, and certainly was in the 90s, a Sherlock Holmes museum, supposedly of Sherlock Holmes artifacts. Now, of course, Sherlock Holmes was a fictional character, but it's in LA. If you go, there's a Sherlock Holmes museum, which has pipes and hats and, you know, the whole bit. But he was obviously a fictional character. Perhaps he was based on a real person or a conglomeration of real people. Or maybe even, do you know if Conan Doyle based Sherlock Holmes on himself or some other figure?
Well, that's an interesting question, Jeremy. I mean, there's been a lot written about this, and in fact, just to mention, I know, you know, most people listening in will plug into YouTube a lot. So there's actually a wonderful Movie Tone interview with Conan Doyle. Mm-hmm. Now, interestingly, this on YouTube it says that this was recorded in 1930. In the descriptor it says it was recorded in October 1928, and in fact that's the date I used for The View. I then subsequently came across another version of the movie with full titles and subheadings and what have you later on after The View was published, and it says quite clearly that it was in the summer of 1927. So that was very kind of strange. But the Movie Tone interview is split into two parts. It's only 10 minutes long. First 5 minutes is very much to do with Sherlock Holmes, and then the second 5 minutes is to do with his interest in spiritualism. Now, as far as Sherlock Holmes was concerned, a great influence was his mentor at Edinburgh University, Dr. Joseph Bell. Conan Doyle was a medical student at Edinburgh University back in the late 1870s, early 1880s. And Bell was a huge influence because he was he used observation a great deal, and he was a consulting. I'm not sure what the term is, but he could look at somebody and they could immediately start to...
Diagnostician.
Yes, that's a good word, yes. It's a bit late on a Sunday night to be...
Yeah.
So, as I said, Bell could, make these wonderful observations about people. And so Conan Doyle took that forward and he thought, well, if doctors could do that... He'd been influenced by people like Edgar Allan Poe, and the murderers in the Rue Morgue, was it Dupont, I think, was the detective. I think he had a slight preference for his approach to other detective fiction at the time, because he said all the rest of it just seemed to rely on a fluke or some sort of twist that didn't have any real meaning to it.
Yes.
So he took Bell's approach into the Sherlock Holmes character and he started to work out these plots. And, of course, he became eventually a prolific writer. Quite slow to start off, but... and in terms of his own influence, I mean, yeah, you're right. I mean, any character in fiction's going to be a bit of a composite, but it was always imagined that Conan Doyle himself was more like the John Watson character,
yes.
Dr. Watson. But I think that's maybe playing himself down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had the... He had the wit, he had the imagination, he had that wonderful scientific brain that really influenced the Sherlock Holmes character as well.
Mm. Yeah. I suppose within each of us there is a part person that is a questioner, somebody who asks questions, how does this work? And then there's another part of us that has the answers, And really, I suppose, this is what this show is all about. The Ever Beyond is about going beyond the personality, the asking of the questions, and let's tap into the source of what is the source of where the questions are answered. So it's interesting that Conan Doyle put himself in the position of being the questioner. He puts himself as Dr. Watson.
Well, that's right.
And Dr. Bell being the great mind that he admires, and turning that round and making the doctor the second guy, and the Sherlock Holmes. Any idea about where he got the name from, Sherlock Holmes?
Sherlock Holmes, my goodness. I mean, it's interesting. Before I really got into all this, I was starting to find myself reading lots of biographies about Conan Doyle and so forth. And you've put me on the spot here because I should remember it. I think Sherlock was the name of somebody who was at his school. He went to a Jesuit school, which I think he hated, but it was down in Stonyhurst, down in I think it was around about Lancashire.
Mm-hmm.
A boarding school, and he was quite young, and he was sent there. And I'm desperately trying to think, because somebody out there will know that there was a name that he had originally, which sounded like Sherlock Holmes, but it was slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
Sherringford, something or other, but obviously Sherlock Holmes is what he eventually ended up with. you mentioned at the station about Ever Beyond. I think it's interesting that we're looking at the view and then the view beyond.
The view beyond, yes.
And it is about asking these questions because, we live in a society where people are looking for quick and easy answers.
Mm.
And it's never quite that simple, and certainly not in this story because, as I say, this has been kind of like part of my life over the last sort of few years. I mean, I would never have dreamt that... as I said, Sir Francis Bacon, I only found out his name February 2010.
Yeah.
And as I explained to you before, I've now been invited by the Francis Bacon Society in London to give a talk a week on Tuesday.
Yeah.
It's like, well, where does this all suddenly come from?
Yeah, so there's a bit of nail-biting there because you're going into a... you're going to tell them about the guy that they've been studying for a long time.
Well, exactly. And there's no way that I can go in and, as some kind of academic who knows it all because I don't, and I don't think they do either, because there are so many strands, just exactly like Conan Doyle.
Mm.
And synchronicity is the big word here. I mean, it's been the kind of watchword of my life, I think, ever since I moved up to the Highlands in 2005. I thought I was only going to be up here for a short period. I moved up from Aberdeenshire, and then all sorts of things started to happen. And I might as well share with you,
yeah,
because I think this is important. I mean, going back, I mean, when I was married and we lost our first son at the age of 1 month, this is in 1980.
Oh, sorry.
It was one of these things. It was a congenital heart defect that had not been picked up at birth. And as anybody out there who's lost a child, I mean, it is the most devastating thing that you could ever imagine. But in amongst all the grief and the anger and the bewilderment, etc., I kind of knew deep down that we'd meet again sometime, and I couldn't say why, I couldn't explain it, I just kind of knew. So the Conan Doyle connection with spiritualism actually led me into spiritualism completely unexpectedly, again through a whole series of synchronicities, because I come from a traditional Church of Scotland background, you know, Protestant, Presbyterian, and then suddenly here I was going into this field. But the point I was going to make about, you know, Lee's death at the age of a month, I mean, one thing it made me do was to have a pact with myself to keep an open mind about spiritual things, you know, check things out, be discerning, hopefully not become gullible.
Because where you came from was a very non-spiritual situation. You were an auditor. That's right.
You
count numbers and...
I was an accountant with Shell at the time. I wasn't in audit at that time, but I did move into audit in the sort of late 1980s.
Right.
But it gave me a real grounding of, you know, what corporate life is actually all about. Yeah. And I think, to be fair, you know, a lot of the work I did enjoy. I enjoyed the travel out and about. But the internal politics and so forth... I suppose it made me aware of a lot of stuff that's actually stood me in good stead now, because we now see a world where corporate control is just, to my mind, completely out of hand with the whole banking situation and, the governments and who is actually in control of what, you know? And as you start to research into these fields, you realise that things are not always what they seem. You know, definitely not.
Everything. everything is not what we've been told. Yeah.
Exactly. And then you start to look at the mainstream media and so forth. But anyway, I mean, going back to Conan Doyle, he spoke about the psychic question. And he'd been a real sceptic about all things psychic and the afterlife and so forth. I mean, the Society for Psychical Research had set up in, I think it was 1882, and he got involved about 1886, I think it was, just about the time when he got married and when the character of Sherlock Holmes was emerging. But he was incredibly sceptical about the whole thing, but he put his analytical scientific mind to it. And it wasn't just him. There were people like Sir Oliver Lodge, Sir William Crookes. I mean, we're talking about the eminent scientists of the day who were really checking this whole area out. And it wasn't till 30 years later, as I said, 1918, or around that time, that he came out in public. And that's why he called his book The Vital Message, because he felt that the scientific evidence... and the proof was all there, indisputably, and he dedicated the rest of his life to getting that message out into the public. Now, you could argue how successful he was with that. I mean, I suppose it was like preaching to the converted. He was going out to Scandinavia, South Africa, America, but they tended to be like spiritualists he was already talking to, you know, reaching the greater... audience, which he'd hoped, didn't quite pan out. But there was an interesting development which I didn't know anything about, and I would suspect most people, even those who are involved in spiritual circles, are not aware of. When I moved up to Nairn, as I said, I got involved with a spiritualist church right out of the blue. I'd been to a psychic fair, turned out it's been run by...
Just a minute. Yes. Everybody, I know what Nairn is.
Okay.
So where is Nairn?
Nairn is it's situated on the Murrayforth coast, about midway between Inverness, which is the Highland capital of Scotland, and Findhorn. And people probably know about the community at Findhorn. It's about 15 miles from each. Yeah. It's got its own microclimate. It's a lovely place. It's got a lovely beach. In fact, Charlie Chaplin used to go there for holidays.
Yes, it's been known in history as a holiday resort.
Well, it has. In fact, it's almost been like a spa resort for people to go and recuperate and such like as well, because it's got very, very healthy air. So as I say, I moved up to there.
So that's where you live, yeah.
Yeah, 2005. And I'd been to a psychic fair in the old community centre there and found out about the connection with the Inverness Spiritualist Church. So I thought, I'll go and check this out. Went along, thought I was only going to be there for one night, and something just seemed to nudge me along to go back. Well, after a month, I got a message from a medium, which completely blew me away, because one of the things she said right up front was, I had a strong connection with the country of Wales.
Yeah.
Now, people would not normally associate me with Wales, but in fact, although my parents are from Edinburgh, and my grandparents, where Conan Doyle was actually born, not in the same place in Edinburgh, but in Edinburgh nonetheless, I was actually born in Cardiff in Wales, because my father was actually working there at the time. So when I started to get this information, I thought, this is interesting. So I was so intrigued, I had a one-to-one with a medium. Jean Glenn's her name. I think it's worth mentioning, because I've got a lot to be thankful for Jean, because I had a one-to-one with her the next day.
How do you spell her name? Can people consult her?
Well, Jean, G-E-A-N, Glenn, G-L-E-N. I'm not sure if she's still operating as a medium now. This is going back to 2005. When I mentioned the next day that I had this interest in Conan Doyle, but I mean, that was just an interest from reading his biographies and so forth. Now, you can take this with a pinch of salt. All I'm going to relate is what she told me. She said, well, he's actually here just now, and he's going to help you with your writing. But at this time, I had no idea that I was going to be writing a book about him. I had other kind of ideas for writing that I had in mind. And as I said, this whole thing led to a series of synchronicities. But the big thing that completely changed it for me was, as I said, having got involved with this spiritualist church and got involved with a development circle and starting to understand how spirit communication worked, etc., in 2007, the woman who runs the library at the church, Kath, just came over to me and said, you've got an interest in Conan Doyle, haven't you? I said, yes. And she said, well, somebody's just donated some books to the library. And here's one in Conan Doyle. Would you like to borrow it before it's officially kind of registered, sort of thing? And I had a look at this book, and it was called The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook.
Right.
Now, I'd never heard of this book. I had no idea who Ivan Cook was. And I started to read this book. And what I discovered was, just to sort of backtrack and give you a bit of historical detail, but Conan Doyle died at his home in Crowborough in East Sussex, I think it is. Yeah, it's East Sussex. On the 7th of July, 1930. I can't remember the exact dates, but in 1931 and 1932, over an 18-month period, Conan Doyle purportedly channeled through a spiritualist medium called Grace Cook. And it wasn't just to Grace, it was like a group of them. And this was really giving his message from the afterlife.
Right.
And what he was saying was that what he had said when he was physically alive was on the right track, but it was limited. And he was now saying that this is the reality of what it's like on the other side. And it also demonstrated how difficult it is to make that communication, because it needed a very good medium like Grace Cook, who was one of the best at the time, to actually be able to make that connection, to allow that
nice
communication.
And clear, yeah.
Absolutely. And that's why they call them mediums, because they're a medium. It's almost like stepping down an electrical charge.
Yes, it's like a transformer.
Exactly.
Can take your mobile phone. If you plugged it into the mains, it would blow up. But
yes.
If you put a little black box and you put a little wire in there, then it's supplying just enough voltage and current to charge the battery without blowing the thing to pieces.
That's right.
So, likewise, spiritual energy is very high energy. and it requires somebody to reach up there and step it down so that we can hear it.
Well, that's exactly it. And that's a point I only really registered relatively recently, that she was actually reaching up way above the astral dimensions into the other realms to make this connection. And similarly with Conan Doyle, I mean, it's very difficult to talk from our kind of reality on this. But
so that was the first book that you...
Yeah, and what I then realised was I'd kind of vaguely heard of White Eagle as a Native American spirit guide, but that was it. It was just a vague notion of White Eagle as a name. And then I discovered there was actually a White Eagle Lodge, and the White Eagle Lodge was set up in 1936 as a direct result of this channeling from Conan Doyle in 1931 and 32, which is written up in this book. Now, The Return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cooke was published initially in 1956, but there had been a previous version of the book called Thy Kingdom Come, also by Ivan Cooke, in 1933, which was immediately after these actual sessions that had taken place.
Sorry, was Ivan Cooke connected with the medium?
Sorry, I should have explained that. Yeah. Ivan Cooke was actually married to Grace Cooke.
All right, so there's the husband of the medium who channeled him. Yes,
that's right.
Okay.
But I should also say that in the sessions, there were usually around about six people who would be involved. There would be, obviously, Grace, there'd be Ivan. Conan Doyle's second wife, Lady Jean, because he remarried in 1908 after his first wife died. She would be there, I think, at most of the sessions. Her two sons, Adrian and Dennis, were there at some of the sessions. There's also a recorder there, Bradbrook was his name, who wrote down all the notes from these sessions. Now, interestingly, rewind a bit. When Conan Doyle died, they were going to put a memorial up to him, and they raised some like £2,000, which is not an insignificant amount of money for those days.
Quite a fair amount nowadays, yeah.
But they couldn't really think of what they wanted to do. And interestingly, part of in his channeling, he said, "Look, it's not about me as a personality. It's this message that's the important bit. This is what he wanted to get out there." Yeah. And I was just so completely blown away by this information that it just lent a completely different aspect to me. And of course, then I started to think, well, how many people actually know about this? You know, and I, if I can say this, I mean, can I honestly believe it, that Conan Doyle has been there to guide me in everything that I've been doing to help get this message out now, you know, and we'll come on to the bacon aspect of things as well. And as I said, these are all connected. For some reason, I've been thrown into this role as a complete, I would say, non-expert.
Yeah.
But it's almost like I've landed in this role because I don't have any kind of baggage or preconceived ideas about things.
Exactly. You can be a clear channel for it.
Well, hopefully. And you know, again, it's interesting that one of the big connections between Conan Doyle and Francis Bacon, as I can see, was they both stood for truth and integrity. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that I would do the same. You know, it's been very, very important in my life. I mean, I just find I can't not act with integrity. You know, and, you know, it's maybe something that's hardwired, I don't know, but maybe that's something that we should all be looking at, because at the end of the day, what we make of our lives is down to us and principles and so forth. You know, we mentioned about the banks and what have you. There are so many people out there who are just not working with integrity. That's their choice. Maybe they're here for a reason to do that, to actually show up the grossness, the corruption, the criminality in the way materialism has, you know, has gone to complete extremes. And now I think we're just sort of rewinding things in now, and saying, well, hold on a minute, this is not what life's about. Because I think even the guys at the top, in inverted commas, are they particularly happy in their lives? They've got all this money, but you know,
they're still being told what to do. Well, they're not free. They're not free. Exactly. They don't have the freedom that we've been looking for.
Yeah.
So at this point, I think we should take a little break.
Okay.
And we'll play the first of your three Desert Island tracks. And which one would you like?
Let's go to Led Zeppelin.
Let's go to Led Zeppelin. Okay, so we're going to have a nice long break, so you can go and make a cup of tea, because it's going to be a very interesting conversation. So we're going to go for Stairway to Heaven. We're going to go up there. So let's just if I start that and fade this in.
To heaven.
Led Zeppelin there, Stairway to Heaven. And we're talking with Dave Patrick this evening. We're discussing Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and where we left off was that Conan Doyle had gone to heaven, and he'd come halfway down the stairway, and Medium had gone halfway up, and they were having a conversation, and that conversation seems to have continued throughout the years in Conan Doyle's ability to overshadow events in some way, including the event of you receiving the book about him.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's hard to believe this is only 2007 that I first became aware of the return of Arthur Conan Doyle, this book that was published in 1956. As I said, there had been a previous version, Thy Kingdom Come, in 1933, and there was a later version called Conan Doyle's Book of the Beyond, published by Colm Hayward in the 1990s. And when it came to getting contributors for my for what became The View, I thought, Colm would be a good guy. Now, Colm Hayward is actually the grandson of Grace Snive and Cook. And if I could maybe mention somewhat poignantly, Colm's mother, Ilana Hayward, I just learnt today that she's passed away at the age of 95. Mm. So I'd just like to register the fact that I actually spent 4 weeks at the White Eagle Lodge in Hampshire last month and spent a lot of time with Ilana and the family, and it was absolutely wonderful to be in that that loving energy, and just a wonderful, wonderful experience. So obviously my thoughts go out to Colm, Jeremy and the family on that one, and the legacy that they've left continues to move forward. So as I said, the White Eagle Lodge itself was set up in 1936 by Grace Cook and Ivan Cook. Now, I mentioned earlier about the Polaire Brotherhood. I don't know if that was when we were with the glitch on air, or whether it was
I think we just about started. But do go into it again, because the word Polaire doesn't make any sense to me. So if you can unpack that a little bit.
Okay, well, the Polaire Brotherhood. This is another interesting strand to the whole story. And I'll explain it as best I can without going into too much detail. But back in 1908, there was a young chap, Mario, who had dealings with a hermit. When I said dealings, he kind of bumped into this hermit in a place called Bagnea, in northern Italy. Mm. And the hermit gave him what became known as, La Force d'Astral. It was a kind of coding machine. It was to do with mathematical coding. And he basically said to Mario, look, if you come to a point in your life where you've hit a crisis, then use La Force d'Astral. And anyway, he did actually come to a point, I think it was in the 1920s. And this is all wrapped up into the beginnings of what became the Polaire Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And Mario was one of the founders. Now, they were actually based in France. Now, the reason this is important is because the Polaires in France, independent of Grace Cook, were guided to go and meet Grace Cook in England. Grace Cook was from the south of England, just outside London. And the kind of symbol that connected the two was the six-pointed star, which in fact has become the symbol of the White Eagle Lodge, the three-dimensional star tetrahedron, which is quite interesting.
It's quite interesting. This is, as we're sitting here, I have one hanging from the ceiling. In fact, I have three nested inside each other of wood, copper and crystal.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I don't know whether we'll have a chance to move on to this, but just to go laterally for a moment, one of the guys in the science field that's had a huge impression on me In recent years, a guy called Nassim Harriman, who's the director of the Resonance Project.
Yes.
And Nassim has demonstrated that the star tetrahedron, the two interlocking three-dimensional triangles, is actually the building block of the universe.
Mm.
Absolutely fascinating.
And that also ties in with Richard C. Hoagland's view of hyperdimensional physics.
Absolutely.
And the 19.5 degree encoding. So wherever you see 195 or 1.95 or 19.5, I always think of dear Richard here.
Yeah.
But it's the angle of the points of the tetrahedron, yeah, as they impinge on the surface of a sphere.
Mm.
Anyway, do go on.
Well, I think what it's demonstrating is that science and spirituality has gone like full circle, and they're now converging very much with each other.
Absolutely.
I mean, one of the contributors to the View, who's had a great influence on me, is a guy called Peter Russell. Peter originated from London, but he now spends his time in Sausalito, San Francisco.
Mm.
But he has got a strong scientific physicist background, but his whole purpose, as he sees it, is to meld together science and spirituality, and he's written a lot of really good stuff on that front. So I mentioned Nassim Harriman. There's a very good 4DVD set called Crossing the Event Horizon for anybody out there who wants to find out a bit more about him. And again, just a thought came into my mind there. I mean, although I've done a lot of research into lots of areas, I've kind of stumbled across a lot of stuff, and it's almost like, with hindsight, I've been guided to find it.
Mm.
And I think people will kind of resonate with that. The internet has become a great tool, and it's when you start making connection, you think, where did that come from? Fascinating stuff.
I've always found that it's the serendipitous connections that we make. We're just looking at something, maybe we might be talking about flowers, and then we look down and there's a thing about feeding flowers, and then you go to sugar and you find out about sugar, and then, you're led from one random thing to another random thing, or it appears to be completely random, and yet that is part of the overshadowing guidance that we're talking about before from the other side.
Absolutely. I mean, the word I would use is synchronicity, mm-hmm. as Jung calls it, a meaningful coincidence.
Mm.
And I think the trick is to follow that guidance that's coming through, because so many people say, oh, it's just a coincidence.
Mm.
And again, I've just found it... if I can just lead on about the Grace Cook story, for example, about how that started to emerge. It was in fact September 2008... I was sitting at home one day. My dad had not long passed away, and I was sitting just having some cornflakes in the living room, and I just stuck the TV on just for something banal to watch while I was eating my cornflakes, and this picture came on screen, and it was a picture of a woman. It was a still picture, it was a painting, very elegant. I would say she was probably in her late 60s. Pastel blue background, but the narrative that was going on with the program didn't fit. It was like a nature program, a wildlife type thing.
Hmm.
I thought, that's weird. And I picked up the remote and I clicked down a channel and I clicked back. Discovered I'd been on BBC Two, and then clicked to BBC One, back to BBC Two, by which time this picture had gone.
Hmm.
And I thought, that's really strange, because it was lions in a wildlife park, a safari park somewhere, and then of course I completely forgot all about this. One of the things that was important that I should have mentioned, after finding about the White Eagle Lodge connection, I actually decided to join the White Eagle Lodge, because I found that the writings of White Eagle really resonated with me. There was a purity to the writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the amount of information that was generated from the 1930s right through to Grace's passing in 1979, I think it was just absolutely amazing. And it's such beautiful prose as well. I mean, it's as I said earlier, but written from the heart,
mm-hmm.
and it connects with your heart as well. And So I had joined the White Eagle Lodge. I'd been to a couple of retreats, but hadn't been that involved. Anyway, I'd been at a retreat in Glasgow, and that's when I first met Colm. And I'd arranged to go down to the White Eagle Lodge in November. This is November 2008. Now, remember, I wanted this book published May 2009. That's still right. Had no publisher.
And you only started the project a month or so earlier.
Well, I actually started in the beginning of October.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... So I thought, I was just kind of following whatever, you know, mm-hmm. just gut feel that if I could get contributors, then somehow it was going to work. So, saw Colm in Glasgow Retreat, and then I met him down at Hampshire at the main White Eagle headquarters. And we're sitting in Newlands house, and he went off to make some coffee and came back. And I'm sitting there, and... And he came back and he said, "Oh, I didn't realise you're going to be sitting at that angle." And I said, "That's okay, though." And anyway, we're chatting away. And he said, "Yeah, look, I like the idea of the book." And as I said, he had already published his grandfather's updated version, Conan Doyle's Book of the Beyond. Mm. So he was steeped in the whole Conan Doyle, Grace Cook, White Eagle, Polaire Brotherhood story. So he said, "Yeah." And then he said... Well, actually, before he said any more, I kind of glanced up and saw this picture on the wall, and it was a painting of a woman. I said, "Who's that woman on the wall, Colm?" He said, "That's actually my grandmother, Grace Cook, or Minesta, to give her mediumistic name."
All right.
He said, "But it's not a very good likeness." And I said, "That's the woman I saw on my TV set less than 2 months previous." And I said, "What do you make of that?" And he said, "Well," he said, "Spirit... I've got a way of using technology in different ways." Mm. He said that was probably his grandmother coming in just to give her blessing on the book idea. I thought, wow, okay. So we're having our coffee, and he said, "Yeah, I'd be delighted to contribute." And then he said, "By the way, have you got a publisher?" And I said, "Well, no." I said, I'm just trying to get contributors at the time. And he said, "Well, I run a small publishing company in London.
How convenient.
Would you like me to publish the book for you?" And as any writers or would-be writers out there will know, that does not happen.
Rare. That's rare.
So, and of course, the name of his publishing mm-hmm. company is Polaire Publishing.
Right.
And although Polaire Publishing is not with the E in the end of Polaire. Mm. But the Polaire Brotherhood story on its own is a fascinating story, you know. And it includes people like Otto Rahn. You know, he was purportedly a member of the Polaire Brotherhood as well. You know, and you could have a whole program on Otto Rahn. I'm no expert on that front.
All right, I'm not familiar with Otto Rahn.
Otto Rahn, well, they reckon that the whole Indiana Jones, the initial, about
searching for... Oh, was he one of the Nazi explorers?
Yeah, because he actually... Well, as I said, I'm not an expert on this front. I don't really want to sort of say too much about it, but...
Was that 7 years in Tibet? Played by Brad Pitt. I'm sure his name was Otto in that movie.
I think that was a different story.
I'm not clear. Anyway, okay.
But Otto Rahn, I know, had connections with the SS, but I don't think he was. Well, I don't know. Yeah. I don't really want to go into areas which. But he was found in mysterious circumstances. Mm. It was either 1937 or 38, on an Austrian hillside, dead. And did he commit suicide or blah blah blah? Mm-hmm. But anyway, there's a connection with the players there. Where was I? So basically, I got a publisher, and this is November 2008, and I said, right, okay, and we ended up collaborating on the book. Mm-hmm. I'd already brought in a number of contributors, then Colm was able to bring others to complement. We ended up with 29 contributors. It was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, I mean, although it was pretty tight going...
You got the book
published? We got the book published on the 22nd of May 2009, which was actually a Friday. Mm-hmm. And we had a one-day conference at the White Eagle Lodge in Hampshire beforehand. So it was just the most fantastic day. And we did the book launch in the evening. Mm. And it's gone down really well. You know, and I just feel... such a joy, the fact that I've been in this position to honour Conan Doyle, and hopefully, as I see it, put the record straight about him as well. Mm. And and open up a lot of the stuff to, you know, kind of a wider audience. So that was, you know, Conan Doyle. If I could maybe say, I mean, just to bring things up to date.
Yes.
As I said, I was down in the White Eagle Lodge for a month in August. I was on a retreat that was actually run by Colm on the ancient brotherhoods. And we actually covered the Essenes, who were around at the time of Christ.
Yes.
The Polar Brotherhood. And in the middle, we had the Cathars.
Yeah. I knew that word was going to come up.
Now, if I don't really want to start, I'm no expert in this field either, but if I can give a bit of an advanced plug here, surprise, surprise, the third book in the View series is going to be on the Cathars, and it's we're aiming to publish that in October 2012, which I think is going to be an interesting day anyway.
It's going to be a very interesting time, yes.
And it's interesting how the Cathars have been coming into the public kind of... imagination more and more, as or awareness. You know, lots of interesting things there,
and that's connected with Provence and in the south of France.
I don't know if it's Provence. Well, certainly that's Carcassonne, Toulouse, Béziers, that kind of area. Not that far from Rennes-le-Château, and you know, there's obviously connections in that whole thing. It's not a part of France I've been to before, but Colm is supposed to be organising a trip, I think spring next year. So if any of the listeners out there are interested in, you know, getting involved in that, you know, get in touch. Is it okay to give my email address out here?
You can give out whatever you like.
Just for the listeners, just to explain, I don't really have a website as such at the moment that's functioning, but I do have a few pages on Facebook. I've got one called The View, which is about the first book, which is called From Conan Doyle to Conversation with God. And I've also got a page called The Vital Message, which is what I use for really putting up anything that I believe is worth sharing. I, you know, put up a lot of YouTube clips to share, share a lot of music, just whatever.
Yep.
You know, so it would be great if people out there would...
Yep, befriend.
Hit the like button, and and Dave Patrick, you want to, you know, befriend me on Facebook. But my email address, all lowercase, is dave@healthyenterprise.com, and it'd be great to hear from anybody. So as I say, that's the plan. The plan is certainly to get the book published next year, The View Beyond the Beyond. I'm sure it'll be called something different from that, but. As I say, this trip to France should be quite interesting. So if Colm's aware that there's people out there that would be interested, then I think that'd be good. Just to bring things up to date on the Conan Doyle front, as I said, I was down in the White Eagle Lodge, which is actually based in a place called Liss in Hampshire. It's right on the West Sussex border. Now, 8 miles up the road is a place called Hindhead, and Conan Doyle actually built a house there in 1896 for his wife Tui, or Tui was her nickname, but Louise was her name. She suffered from TB, and he'd taken her out to Switzerland, Davos a few times, to the sanatorium out there, to improve her condition. In fact, when he was in Switzerland, that's when he came across the Reichenbach Falls, which was the inspiration for The Final Solution, when Sherlock Holmes was killed off with Moriarty the first time around.
Right.
So obviously Sherlock Holmes came back to life as well, 10 years after. I don't know if you're aware of that story, but Conan Doyle didn't really want to be known most for Sherlock Holmes. He felt that was a kind of trivial part of his writing. He wanted to be known for his historical novels. And yet it's Sherlock Holmes that has kind of stayed alive in the public kind of view.
Yeah.
And he tried to kill off. Well, he did, in fact. He put Moriarty and Holmes over the Reichenbach Falls, and people were actually wearing black armbands in the streets of London. And there was a huge campaign to bring Holmes back. Well, he did eventually, about 10 years on, with the Hound of the Baskervilles, and that was when he was living at Hindhead, because he built the house there. Now, the reason I'm saying this is topical is there's actually. A save, Undershaw's the name of the house. There's actually a trust that's been set up to try and save Undershaw, because unfortunately he's been allowed to, you know, become really dilapidated. And the trust, the patron of the trust is Mark Gatiss, who is the producer and writer for the new Sherlock series. There's an awful lot of other celebrities who've come on board, like Stephen Fry. The person on the ground who's doing the most is an amazing woman called Lynn Gale, who's a personal friend, who actually works at the White Eagle Lodge in Liss, but she lives in Hindhead. And she's been a real driving force behind the trust. And although it, in some ways it looks a bit of a lost cause because it's become so run down, the local council just want it.
They want to demolish it.
Well, there's a developer in there that wants to convert it to flats. The usual story. You know, and even at this 11th hour, we're really looking to do what we can to revitalise this whole project, because it should be a no-brainer. I mean, I don't know if you know that part of the country, but Hindhead, there's recently been built a Hindhead tunnel, which is to do with the Olympics for next year, because it's the main road for driving down from London to, I'm not sure if it's Weymouth or somewhere, we're down there where they're going to have the yachting. So Hindhead itself, where it was a bustling, busy place with horrendous traffic problems, has now gone back to this like sleepy Victorian kind of town.
I see that they've packaged the bypass underneath the place rather than around it.
That's right, and so that all the traffic's moved away. So they're now looking at ways to regenerate Hindhead, and it should be a no-brainer.
Yeah,
you know, because people worldwide know about Sherlock Holmes. I mean, it's only 50 miles from London. You know, and you know what we'd like to see is, when I say we, the trust, I'm kind of a bit on the side of this, but yeah, a living, breathing centre to honour Conan Doyle. Now, it shouldn't just be some kind of nostalgic relic. In fact, there's a local councillor, I won't name him on air, but who is very supportive of our project. And he asked me, you know, what would I like to see? You know, why is it important to me? And I just immediately came out with, well, this should be a symbol for the new consciousness, you know. And it's interesting that we're now revisiting, or I'm certainly revisiting and trying to share with others, that kind of knowledge and wisdom of there we go again, Conan Doyle, from like the 1920s and before, you know, because this is timeless. This you know, and having been involved with quote spiritualism, you know, which is an unfortunate kind of label.
Lots of old blue rinse ladies, table tipping and all that stuff. But I'm sure, I mean, certainly, I mean, from my research, I discovered that the discovery of television, the cathode ray tube, was originally invented to try and image spirits from the other side.
That's right.
Part of the Psychical Research Foundation, who created the cathode ray tube that then Logie Baird started to use as a display for his television system.
Yeah,
mechanically.
Well, I think it was actually Sir Oliver Lodge. It was either Lodge or Crookes that I mentioned earlier. I think it was Lodge, and I've actually a funny feeling there's a plaque to this in one of the universities. I'm not sure if it's Oxford or something like that. But of course, you know, it's interesting because we have so much suppression of stuff by the scientific establishment.
Well, let's get real. The military-industrial complex, the chief suppressors of knowledge and wisdom in our modern world.
Well,
and the scientists they go along with it. But
they're all part of this kind of matrix game that we, you know, are now appreciating more and more is being played. Maybe this is actually a good point to jump onto Francis Bacon, actually.
Well, what I think this is a good point is to have a break, because we're now at the top of the hour, and I think it would be nice to put a bit of Mr. Green on. Okay, so here we are. We're going to play Peter Green in the Splinter Band with Supernatural. And welcome back. We're talking tonight with Dave Patrick, editor of The View Beyond and The View, The View was about Conan Doyle. The View Beyond was about Conan Doyle and Francis Bacon. So let's... No? Just about Francis Bacon?
Yes.
He's nodding on the... So we have The View and we have The View Beyond. So how do they connect together?
Well, maybe I should just give a bit of an intro about the View Beyond Francis Bacon.
Yes.
If you remember, I said that he'd come at me kind of from left field.
Yes.
So I honestly had not heard of Sir Francis Bacon before February 2010.
Right.
And as I said, when the publisher came and asked me if I'd do that as a follow-up, mm-hmm. obviously I said, yeah, great. And then, gulp, where do I start?
Mm.
Now... there's maybe a couple of strands of synchronicities that I... one synchronicities and one kind of researchy, if you like, mm-hmm. that I can maybe just try and sure. piece together. On the synchronicity front, back in... well, it was the following week after Colm had asked me to do this book, or edit it,
mm-hmm.
Obviously in collaboration with himself. My friend Phil, who lives in Nairn and is involved in, you know, a lot of esoteric type stuff as well, earth energy healing, etc. And he's a good friend. I mean, his trade is he's a joiner and he's a very good craftsman. Mm. But we kind of keep ourselves grounded, go for a pipe every so often, and saying, well, you know, what do you make of this? And blah blah blah. Anyway, Phil had said to me one day. Google a couple of terms. He said, Le Serpent Rouge and the Dagobert documents.
Mm.
Okay, and I thought, okay, well, I'd kind of vaguely heard. I'd heard about the Dagobert documents through the whole
Holy Grail, Dagobert, yes.
Exactly, yeah. But coincident with this, there was a program on TV that night. I don't watch much TV, but this is Horizon. There's a program called Beyond Infinity.
Mm-hmm.
And... I thought, okay, so I was watching this program, and it was an hour long, and after about 10 minutes, I'm sort of, because they were saying things like, well, is infinity really infinity, or does it get to a big number, and then it sort of goes back to zero and mm-hmm. start again? So
mm-hmm.
I thought, oh God, I think my head's starting to hurt. So I jokingly texted Phil, and I said, you know, I think it's doing my head in. So I had a bit of banter and, texting on our mobiles. And then I just plucked this thing out of the air about Hitchhiker's Guide, you know, the answer is 42.
Yeah.
So, of course, I just put in, well, of course, the answer's 42.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back and he said, no, the answer's number 9. I thought, number 9? I thought, well, the house I lived in at the time was number 9. But I thought, what's he talking about? So I texted back, what do you mean by number 9? Then I just started playing around with numbers, and the numbers, you know, saying, well, 9 is 3 times 3, and
so it's a cube number.
Yeah, and it's, you know, 4 times 2 plus 1, or 4 plus 2 plus 3.
It's not a square number.
Or 4 plus 2 is 6, and of course 6 is 9 upside down.
Mm-hmm.
You're just joking about.
Mm.
Now, the program finished, then I thought, right, he'd asked me to look at Googling this Dagobert documents in the Serpent Rouge, completely unconnected, or so I thought.
So you thought.
So I went on and through a whole series of kind of links, I ended up on this website, which is a very important one. If anybody wants to check it out, it's MontagueKeen.com.
Okay. Let me just type that. That's
www.montagueKeen.com. And unfortunately, it's not actually there at the moment. I'm not sure what's happened, but the website is, but this particular book review isn't there, because there's a book review on it by Peter Welsford.
Mm-hmm.
Who happens to be the chairman of the Francis Bacon Society.
Right.
Now, remember, I hadn't heard of Francis Bacon until the previous week.
Right.
Okay.
So.
And the book review was on a book called The Tree of Life and the Holy Grail, The Mystery of Rennes Le Château by a woman called Sylvia Franke.
Right.
F-R-A-N-C-K-E.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I looked at this review and I started to read down it, I got about two-thirds of the way down, and it was like, it was a real oh my god situation, because it suddenly mentioned the return of Arthur Conan Doyle by Ivan Cook. Not only that, it's talking about the importance of the number nine, 3x3, and so it went on. In fact, as I said, it's interesting because from that review on that website, Veronica Keane, who runs the website, because she basically gets a message each week from her husband Monty, who actually died in 2004.
Right, so he's on the other side.
He's on the other
news
side.
From the other side every week.
Yeah, but he's seemingly, according to Veronica, is working with people like John Mack.
Mm-hmm.
If you've come across his work, he died a few years ago. In fact, he was actually turned out he was staying with Veronica in London. He was actually knocked over by a car. And I think at the time people said it seemed a bit suspicious, but no.
John Mack, so what's his
American
area?
He's American, and he'd done a lot of work to expose a lot of the, you know, kind of black ops in the States and so forth,
I see.
As I understand it. But it seems to have been a genuine accident that it was actually his time to go as well. Peter Welsford, chairman of the Francis Bacon Society, and of course Peter's invited me to give a talk a week on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
At Canonbury Tower in London, where Bacon actually lived for 10 years of his life. It's a wonderful...
Canonbury is a lovely place.
It is.
It's one of the loveliest parts of London.
It is, absolutely. And Sylvia Franke, I kind of knew that she was somebody I had to contact, so I did a bit of searching, and came across her name with a phone number, and I thought, well, do I just phone this person? She might be out of date, she might not even be alive, I don't know anything about her. So I phoned the number anyway, immediately got on the other end, and we started swapping these stories about synchronicities. So the three of us, well, myself and Veronica, Peter, Sylvia, we all become, you know, good friends. Sylvia already knew Peter, obviously, and knew Veronica, and so that was the kind of start. And then in Sylvia's, well, what Sylvia and I agreed to do was we'd do a book swap. She lives in south of London, Leatherhead area. So I sent her a copy of The View. She sent me a copy of her book, The Tree of Life and the Holy Grail. Now, in the book, it talked about a chakra system, a line running from Saint-Marie de la Mer in the south of France, where Mary Magdalene was supposed to have landed after the crucifixion. Was Jesus there as well? Good question.
My personal idea is that Jesus sort of dropped her off.
Well,
went with her and then went back to India. Okay. That's my chronology, but you know, that's
I don't know. Yeah. But anyway, this line ran through these seven chakra points. Now,
all in France?
Not all in France. I'll explain them.
Okay,
this came from Peter Dawkins, who's actually a contributor to The View Beyond. He's actually looked at the authorship question, the Shakespeare authorship question, which is another element.
We'll see if we can dip into that.
Anyway, so you've got Saint-Marie de la Mer, which is the, according to this line, the base chakra. You've got Chartres as the second chakra, the sacral.
Sacral, right.
You've got London as the solar plexus, the third one. You've got York as the... have I missed one out? Sorry, I haven't missed one out. The second one's actually Rennes-le-Château.
Right.
The third one's Chartres.
Yeah.
Fourth one's London.
Right.
Fifth one is Roslyn Chapel, outside Edinburgh. I've missed it out again.
Let's go from the lower chakras. You've got the base center, the sacral center, and the solar plex. So
well, the base center is numbers 1 to 7.
Okay.
So one is definitely Saint-Marie de la Mer.
De la Mer, yeah.
Then we've got Rennes-le-Château the second.
That's
we've got Chartres the third.
That's the sixth, right? Yep.
We've got London the fourth.
The heart center.
Ah, right. We've got York the fifth.
Yeah.
We've got Roslyn Chapel the sixth.
Right.
And then the seventh, according to what Sylvia said, was in the Highlands of Scotland, in a place shrouded in mystery. I thought, I live in the Highlands.
Yeah.
I wonder where. So anyway, I spoke to her. Now there's a bit of kind of debate about this, and I haven't kind of resolved it yet, because when I spoke to Sylvia, I said, "Well, I wasn't allowed to sort of give out the point until the place until we made sure it was totally protected and blah blah blah. And I said okay, but she said, but I need to mention this because it's all kind of part of the synchronicity. She said, it's actually a place called Greenstone Point. And I thought, where's that? So I did a search, and it turns out it's in the wilds of Westeros.
Yes. I tell you why.
Okay.
Because there is a grid.
Yeah.
That overlays the Earth, the dodecahedron.
This is to do with the Becker-Higgins grid.
Yes.
Okay.
That's where that point is.
Well, I'm not sure if it is actually.
Because it's kind of over west. It's sort of north of Ullapool and all of that stuff.
No, it's not. No? It's actually upside Akeltibuie. I know the point you mean, which is...
That's Akeltibuie.
Yeah.
Oh, I've been there a few times now.
No, not Akeltibuie. Sorry, no. Alt Bay.
All right.
That's
okay.
But as I say, just in the middle of...
Yeah.
Well, on this promontory.
On the west coast, yes. Yeah.
So, so anyway, I got this information. Now, coincident with that, a friend of mine came up to stay with me for a couple of days, and he had, he said, you know, we're sitting having a cup of tea, just like we're doing in this wonderful studio, and he said, Dave, he said, I don't normally carry crystals, but for some reason I put this in my pocket, and he took out this green crystal.
Green stone.
Green stone. I thought, okay, there's a bit of a clue here.
Yeah.
So, I said, he was just staying for a couple of days, and he said, you know, what do you fancy doing? And I said, well, I think we should go and visit this place. So we went out there, we found out we got a B&B over on the west coast, and went out there, and it wasn't particularly remarkable. There was an interesting small sort of stone circle there, but we just sat and did a meditation and just asked for, you know, the highest good, whatever. And then we came back, and anyway, this same friend, I was staying with him the following month. And this is down in Dunbar, which is just outside Edinburgh. So again, it was a case of, you know, what a day to kill, and what do you fancy doing? I've completely missed the important part of the story. That weekend, I'd been staying with my daughter in Edinburgh. Okay, now I had been to a meeting in Edinburgh. Nothing to do with this stuff. It was just a meeting, but I'd got speaking to this woman who'd gone through this horrendous health crisis, but she happened to mention the fact that there was a woman, Fiona Murray, who'd been very important in her recovery. Now, for whatever intuitive reason, I just knew that Fiona Murray was somebody I had to contact. Now, the following day, this was on the Saturday, the following day I was in the Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh with my daughter, and I was due to begin through to see my friend in Dunbar that evening. So we're in the Botanic Gardens, came back in. My daughter Fiona said she was just going to go into the visitor shop. I said, okay. And I happened to spot a plaque on the wall. And it was to do with Sir Patrick Geddes. I don't know if you've come across him. He's actually a contemporary of Conan Doyle. And we had this...
Isn't he the grandfather of David Cameron?
I certainly hope not.
No, okay.
I don't think it is.
There's a Geddes that is connected with Cameron. Maybe it was Geddes House. Anyway, sorry, completely...
Yeah, I think David Cameron's connected with Huntley around about there.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah,
there's no...
All right.
No, Patrick Geddes was born in Ballater in Deeside, where I used to live.
All right. It's just over the hills, isn't it?
Yeah, but he was... We were talking earlier about, you know, learning from nature, not through books, but direct experience, and that's very much what Geddes was about. You know, by living we learn was one of his mottos, and by leaves we live. So anyway, I'd actually studied Geddes because it was his 150th. He was born in 1854. I'd studied him, and I thought, another remarkable man, a real polymath, same as Conan Doyle. But anyway, on the Botanic Gardens, there was a plaque, and it said the Patrick Geddes room upstairs, and I thought, oh, be interesting. Just nip up and have a look, artifacts and so forth, and books maybe, and whatever. So I went up and found this room that had nothing in it. There was a woman there. She'd been doing a Tibetan gongs workshop. Anyway, we got chatting, and she said, you know, been really busy. She'd run three back-to-back sessions with these Tibetan gongs. Now, so I just started chatting. I told her about my writing. I told her about one thing we haven't covered. I'm also a quantum touch, certified quantum touch instructor and practitioner. So we're kind of discussing stuff around health, healing, writing, etc. And anyway, her name was Suzanne Harris, and she's from Peebles in the Borders. And she said, yeah, she'd had a very busy weekend, because not only had she been busy that afternoon, but the previous day, she'd been running a workshop jointly with her good friend Fiona Murray, at which point I burst out laughing. And she said, what are you laughing at? I said, well, I've just heard this name yesterday from somebody. This is obviously somebody I need to meet.
Absolutely. And you're a friend of hers. Wow.
Yeah, and as I said, I'd never met Fiona Murray before. And so the following morning, by this time I'd gone through to my friend's house in Dunbar. We're having breakfast, and he said, right, what do you fancy doing? Could you get out to St Abbs or whatever? I said, well, I feel drawn to go and visit Fiona Murray if she's around. She stays in a place called Bigger, which is quite near Peebles, and it was about an hour's drive from Dunbar. So he said, oh, I was at a talk by Fiona Murray just a few weeks ago in Huntington or something. I think I've got her card upstairs.
Oh, excellent.
So he went up and got the car. Now, although it was April last year, it was actually a very sunny day.
Mm.
So I'm sitting out, Dunbar's on the coast, I'm sitting out in the patio, we're having breakfast, and I was having this cup of tea, and he came in behind me, and it was one of these sort of moments, and I had my mouth half full of tea.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Dave, he said, yeah, I've got her number. And by the way, it was her that gave me that greenstone crystal.
Ah.
And of course, I just went,
yes.
So, I mean, it gets even more, you know. So then we phoned up Fiona, and she said, yeah, she's had a busy weekend. This was on the Monday now. She said, happy for us to go through and visit. So we went through. So there's four of us sitting in the room, because there's Fiona's partner, now husband, Richard, in the room. So the four of us were having a cup of tea. We did a book swap, because she'd gone through this amazing journey as well, health-wise. I mean, she's now only about 30, but when she was 23, she had been bedridden for about a year. And during that period, she became very clairaudient.
Mm.
And she started to get messages from the other realms, you know, the angelic kingdom, the devas, the nature spirits, ascended master, whoever. And she was actually, you know, starting to take notice of this. So she's now got her website, if I can give her a plug, elementalbeings.co.uk. So we had this amazing discussion. So we're sitting in this living room in the lodge house where she lives, her and Richard. She suddenly said, there's somebody sitting in that seat over there and he wants to talk to us. And she says, I don't normally do this, but he's insistent, he's got a message for us. This is Arthur Conan Doyle.
Oh, wow.
Right, so I might as well tell you what
I'm saying,
right? Yeah. So Conan Doyle, she says, I don't normally do this. She says, in my workshops, I channel for bigger groups, but I say I never do it for one-to-one or small group.
Mm.
So Richard got this on an MP3 player. So it was about 10 minutes. And the message that he was giving us was basically to go out to the spiritualist churches to let them know that proof of the afterlife wasn't the be-all and end-all. It was about spiritual development in this lifetime that's important.
Mm.
I'm sort of going, this kind of rings a bell somewhere.
Yes.
This is exactly the message he came out with in 1931-32. And at the risk of offending spiritualists, because you know, I certainly would not want to do that, but I sometimes wonder if spiritualism has actually moved on from that period, because there is still this almost like dependency on mediums to act as this interim messenger.
Yeah.
And we're now at a stage where, I know we've had these discussions before, we have the wherewithal to make that direct connection ourselves.
Absolutely. And every human can channel.
Absolutely. And this is where the White Eagle Lodge comes in. I'm not saying they're the only ones, that's the route that I've chosen to go, but what they do is very much to do with meditation. Because sin, I mean, I'd ask the question, well, since Grace Cook died, who is there now to channel White Eagle? And it's like, well, that's not really the point anymore. You've actually got the wherewithal to do it, you know, using the wisdom that's already been built up. I'm actually starting to get something. It's either a spider and cobwebs, or there's some spiritual connection here as I'm talking. So, as I said, you know, this is very much to do with following this line of synchronicity, because otherwise I could just say, oh, it's just a complete coincidence.
Yeah.
So, of course, having made that connection, and, you know, I think to go back onto the Francis Bacon front, because I've probably covered enough of Conan Doyle for the moment.
I think we definitely need to move forward into the Bacon territory. Because that's such a rich seam, you know.
Oh, gosh.
Bacon is a very rich
seam. The first thing I did was, not knowing anything about him, I thought, well, what am I going to write about? So I did a bit of initial research, and the first two things that were thrown up were Buried Treasure and his book The New Atlantis, which was a kind of utopian vision for a future future society, which was actually focused towards what became the United States of America. Now, the Buried Treasure aspect, there were actually two locations. One was Oak Island in Nova Scotia, and the other one was in Bruton Vault in Colonial Williamsburg in Virginia in the States. So I thought, okay, well, I could write a chapter kind of like weaving those things together. I mean, if nothing else, just to get an understanding of what it's about, bring it up to date. And then in terms of the New Atlantis, well, the obvious question was, well, if he was painting this utopian vision for the future for America, and he was very much talking about a scientific revolution that was going to benefit everybody across the board. And I thought, well, how come in America, and you could say in this country, in Western Europe, wherever, we seem to have ended up with a scientific dictatorship, as I would call it, which is there to benefit the few? And I know you mentioned, you know, the military industrial complex, and the way science is, you know, fits into that whole kind of framework. And I thought, well, that's kind of like an obvious kind of question. And again, intuitively, I knew there was some kind of connection between the two. Now, when I looked at the practicalities of looking at the Buried Treasure aspect, I thought, well, I can't afford to go out to the States and Canada to research it directly. And I haven't got time anyway. Oh, wait a minute. I do dowsing. I'm part of a dowsing group. I wouldn't say I'm a great dowser. But I've, you know, used dowsing, pendulum dowsing. But my friend Mark Harris runs a dowsing group that I belong to. Maybe I could discuss things with Mark. Maybe we could do some remote dowsing here. So we got together, and he said, yeah, I'm up for that. So without giving too much away, because the chapter we ended up writing, I called it Bacon, Buried Treasure and a Burning Desire to Help Humanity. This is for the View Beyond. Excuse me. In fact, the first bit of dowsing, when I say we, it was actually Mark and his wife and a friend who got together. I set them some questions, really focused around Bacon himself, some looking at Bruton Vault in Virginia and the other one looking at Oak Island. I mean, they're fascinating stories in their own right. I mean, just to explain a bit about Bacon for people who are not aware, and I certainly wasn't aware until relatively recently.
Yeah, that's good. Because give an overview of who Bacon was. Because,
well, one level, you know, a lot of people have said, well, was he the real author of Shakespeare? You know, and I can't say I've been researched into this a lot, but to my mind, there's no way that William Shakespeare or Shakespeare the person could have written all this amazing stuff. I believe it was a group that Bacon was connected into and very much tied into the early stages of Rosicrucianism. And I think in their kind of thinking, as far as I understand it, they were looking for a much freer society, much more knowledgeable society, whether it be free research, free knowledge dissemination, etc., etc. So I I believe that Bacon was working with a group. Now, in fact, this is just something I thought about in the last few days. I mean, Bacon is also seen to be an ascended master in the lineage of Saint-Germain, Roger Bacon, who was no relation, possibly Christopher Columbus, possibly even Carl Jung more recently, but certainly the violet flame energy, mm-hmm. the Saint-Germain element. And I thought, well, if Francis Bacon really had that energy that he was born into, then of course he'd been able to make that divine connection. Now, when we're coming back to the scientific side of things, what Bacon is often blamed, in a sense, and I think wrongly, for being the kind of founder of the modern scientific method. Now, I actually spoke to Peter Dawkins about this on the phone just a week or so ago, and what Peter felt and what I kind of resonate with is that Bacon had come up with this amazing methodology which he called the Great Instauration, okay, and it was different levels of really getting into nature and really understanding through experimentation, through a process of induction, as he called it. Interesting that he talks about induction. Sherlock Holmes was about deduction.
Yes.
Where was I going with this? So Bacon had come up with a great installation, but what Peter Dawkins felt was the missing bit in the modern scientific method is our connection with the divine that is completely omitted. You know, and yet we, you know, anybody who's involved in any kind of creative expression, mm. whether they're painters or writers or musicians or whatever, a lot of them will acknowledge that connection that's there. Yeah, and yet we have this materialistic scientific method that, as we said earlier, is benefiting the few.
Yeah,
and it's all down to money. Now, exactly. Again, it's interesting that the New Atlantis, which was written as a fictionalised account, the island of Bensalem, as they call it, was actually a society that didn't need money, didn't live with money. And I believe, going back to Atlantis times, they didn't need money either.
No.
They just kind of got on with things. They knew what had to be done and got on with it. You know, we've now reached a stage in society. It's like, well, certainly in the view, I asked the question, well, why are we tied in, or a lot of people tied into this spinning wheel of working 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, for what? You know, for the pension, for the mortgage, and so, yeah. But is that really what humanity is about? I don't think so.
No. We've spoken with many people, and it seems to be mostly about slavery, about keeping us indentured slaves, yes. So, So really what we're talking about is that the plan that Bacon had laid out and that Conan Doyle was wanting to promote has been completely sidetracked and co-opted by the military-industrial complex and the people behind that.
Well, that's right. And
you and many others would like to see this restored to its pristine condition.
Well, I think it's already happening, as you know. I mean, the Earth itself is a sentient being, and vibrationally, it's being raised. So our consciousness is being raised, as I understand it, whether we like it or not. We either go with it, or we, get to heck out of here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're getting to the stage where, you know, and I know in the kind of in this kind of area, you talk about the dark hats and the white hats and whatever, but. Mm-hmm. You know, the dark hats have got to really ask themselves the question, well, are they going to continue to work in this kind of narrow kind of domain of greed and selfishness or whatever? I mean, yeah, David Wolcock, I think, you know, I'd have to acknowledge him as a huge influence in my thinking over the last sort of few years, you know, ever since I saw the Edgar Cayce connection with him.
Yeah.
Because Cayce is somebody I looked into quite a bit in the past, but a lot of David Wolcock stuff has been very helpful to understand a lot of this. I mean, the service to self and the service to others, as he calls it, I think is a very, very good way of putting it. And also, when you look at the powers that be at the highest level, you know, the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the quotes, the Illuminati, you know, I mean, the fact that we we have these different factions who in the main are looking to create this new world order, one world government, which is now becoming so obvious to, to people who even do the slightly...
And an obvious tyranny.
Absolutely. And, you know, people are really starting to waken up. What if I can acknowledge one person who's actually contributed to the view beyond, Birgitta Jónsdóttir, who's the leader of the Movement Party in Iceland. Now, they got elected on 7% of the national vote, I think in 2009. They were set up from scratch, really, to fight back against the bankers and the economic hitmen that were trying to bring the country down. And, you know, Birgitta, I would have to say, has demonstrated what Peter Dawkins was talking about in terms of Francis Bacon, that what it is really all down to is what he calls love in action.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's this love in action and the divine connection. And, it, you know, again, it, you know, once people start to get it, they should realise that this is the way to go.
So, should we take a little break now? And we'll play All About Love by Eric Clapton and the Blues Breakers. Eric Clapton and the Blues Breakers. All my love. All my love, all your love.
All your love.
All your love.
Well, you should actually mention John Mayall, because it's John Mayall's Blues Breakers.
John Mayall's band, I'm sorry.
From, I think it was the Beano album. But, yeah, it was John Mayall and vocals there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very distinctive sound.
Excellent.
But, I think it's just a general point. We shouldn't forget the importance of music in all this consciousness revolution.
Yes.
You know, I mean, 60s was really a kind of melting pot of just some fantastic stuff, and I think that's paved the way for, you know, what's going on now. You know, great guitarists, you know, Clapton, Peter Green, Jimmy Page, etc. And I've got to give a plug to the new guy, I believe nowadays, Joe Bonamassa.
All right.
Absolutely compelling. I mean, not just his guitar playing, but his vocals.
But also back to music and esoterics, as Hendrix was quite an esoteric influence on music. For instance, the way he tuned the guitar, he tuned his guitar down to 432 hertz, which is known to be more natural feeling.
Yeah,
may have done it consciously, knowing that, or he may have done it completely unconsciously and just tuning to the guitar to how it felt right in his heart.
Yeah,
you know, when the E is there on the 432, you feel it in the heart.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, I know we had a previous discussion about Hendrix. I mean, Hey Joe, I know that was his first single, but that's always been my favourite track.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a simple melody and so forth, but it just kind of gets me.
Yes.
You know, it just does something. And if, you know, if I maybe just mention this briefly on Conan Doyle, when I went to visit Undershaw when I was down south last month, as I was walking down the drive, I just had this burst of energy in my heart chakra. It was just, it just about knocked me over. And that was what kind of demonstrated to me the importance of this place, not as the building, but as this kind of centre of consciousness, you know, this kind of, and I think Conan Doyle would love to see that, you know, and even when I was working the White Eagle Lodge and going through all the old archives and the old material and the wisdom, and it was like, oh my God, this stuff needs to get out there. People need to know about it, because it is so liberating.
And all people get is the X Factor. Olympic Games.
Yeah.
And
I mean, one of the things I should have said about Conan Doyle was, you know, what was one of the big messages? It was to get rid of what he called the mad fear of death.
Yes.
Because we're eternal souls. So why do we get so hung up? You know, life is here to be lived. Yeah, and be in the now, as they say.
Don't
get anxious about what might happen tomorrow, which probably won't.
Mm.
Or regret what you did yesterday, because that's just part of where you've got to today. Do whatever you need to do in the moment and enjoy it, just like we're doing just now.
Yep.
This is fantastic.
Yes.
In this galactic starship, it's floating.
There's the front view screen there.
Yeah.
We're headed towards the Pleiades, I believe.
Yeah. I mean, just going back onto the Bacon front. Mm. In fact, maybe kind of pulling out something that I was going to end my talk on a week on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. But
well, it's always good to give a couple of nuggets.
Yeah, well, something that arrived completely unexpectedly. I know we, you know, you and I have spoken before about the Mayan calendar and Dr. Carl Kalman's version of it, which he reckons, you know, the end of the ninth wave is going to end 28th of October 2011.
Yes.
Now, completely unconnected, or so I thought, with this research on bacon, I looked at Kalman's website just the other day just to check up on, you know, what the latest thinking was. Stumbled across, there you go, that word again, stumbled across this page, which showed, well, at the bottom of the page, it had a bit of what he called the history of writing.
Hmm.
And the period he was actually covering on the final part of this, and it was all to do with the internet and stuff like that, how that was all emerging. But the dates were very interesting because it was 1617 to 2011.
Mm.
Now, Bacon lived from 1561 to 1626, allegedly. I mean, whether he then faked his death and moved on and worked in Germany, I mean, that's another story. Now, Shakespeare himself, William Shakespeare, the actor who was involved in all this, died in 1616. The first folio of the Shakespeare plays wasn't published till 1623, the same year as the latest edition of the Advancement of Learning and Novum Organum, I think it was called, by Bacon. So 1617 was like pivotal to all this emergent work that was being done. So from a kind of simplistic point of view, I thought, well, maybe you could look at this as being a seed that was planted by Bacon in 1617 that is now coming to maturity.
Absolutely.
In 2011, and it's now coming to the surface.
Let's not forget that writing and reading was not available to the general public in the English language.
That's right.
Until probably very close to that time.
Well, in fact, the Shakespeare plays and Bacon introduced a lot of new words and new expressions to the English language.
Mm.
And what it was saying, in the Kalman webpage, was that writing itself is actually a very, very powerful vehicle to help us raise our consciousness.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tremendous power in words.
Yes, and interestingly now, here in 2011, the use of these things has reduced writing to a very...
You better see what these things are.
These things, I'm sorry, I just picked up my mobile phone here. And the language that people use in texting to save key presses and things like that is highly condensed. It's like we've zipped up the verbosity of the old days, and we can put a lot of information across in a very short period of time using this language, even just using punctuation characters to make little faces and things like that. You can say, he went and had a little sad face, and you know all the story.
Yes.
Well,
that's quite interesting because that kind of fits back into Bacon as well, because he was a great code maker and cipher originator, because he worked for the Secret Service as well. So
we're going to have to talk another day about his connection with John Dee and the Secret Service and all of that stuff.
007.
Yes,
exactly. Of course.
Yeah.
But one thing I would like to say is, the buried treasure aspect. I mean, Oak Island in Nova Scotia is reckoned to be the longest-running treasure hunt.
Mm.
It's been on the go since 1795. And it's known as the... the pit. There's a shaft that goes down about 220 feet.
Oh.
And there's all sorts of water ingress and so forth. So that's been going on. Mark Finnan... who's a contributor to The View Beyond, he's written a lot of stuff on Oak Island, so he's kind of like the expert in that field. Bruton Vault in Williamsburg is an interesting one, because there are groups who are looking to uncover what they reckon is buried treasure there, but the ground that Bruton Church is actually located on is owned, surprise surprise, by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And for some reason the Rockefeller Foundation are not too happy, seemingly, to have this information revealed, but I think somewhere along the line it will be. I think we're reaching the stage now where where truth is coming out regardless.
All secrets revealed.
All the secrets are being revealed. Yeah. You know, it's just a wonderful time. If I can maybe just say a bit of other new research I stumbled across. Anybody who's heard of the Winchester Mystery House in California, I came across, it was actually a PDF online called The Lost Secret of William Shakespeare by a guy called Richard Allen Wagner. Now, I'd heard of the Winchester Mystery House. This kind of like seemed to be some sort of folly in, I think it's San Jose. But it was a fascinating story. It was featured on Most Haunted on TV a few years back. Sarah Winchester was an heiress. She was married to the guy who owned the Winchester Rifle Company,
right,
which it was the Henry Rifle Company, and he bought it out and so forth. Now, try and cut a long story short, because now we're running out of time, but he died at a very young age. Their daughter died. She was left this wealthy heiress. I mean, she'd been to see a spiritual medium in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
The medium had said to her that the Winchester rifle, and especially the 1873 version, I think, had such an effect in creating carnage in the old kind of Wild West. Indians were being killed, but also the Indians were using the Winchesters as well. And it was just this bloodbath. And she was told that she had to go and build this what became known as the Winchester Mystery House to almost, you know, fight back against the bad spirits, and the good spirits were going to help her to build this house. So she moved out to California in 1884 and built this house 24/7 with a squad of labourers, brickies, whatever, until 1922. Now, I think I'm going to have to leave this dangling a bit, but Richard Allen Wagner has actually shown that the house is actually built on higher dimensional mathematical principles, which actually originated through Francis Bacon.
Right.
And
well,
it's very, very interesting.
Lots of very interesting threads there. So let's tie this together, Dave. We've only got about a minute to go. First of all, let's reiterate your website pages.
Well, as I said,
you've got some Facebook pages.
Facebook, I mean, people can connect to me directly on Facebook,
yep,
my own personal page.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the Vital Message page,
mm-hmm,
and I've got the View page.
Mm-hmm.
Losing my voice here.
Yep. Don't worry, not long to go.
My email address is dave@healthyenterprise.com.
Right.
I think that's probably enough.
Okay.
As I say, anybody in the London area, I'm giving a talk at the Francis Bacon Society on the 20th.
And this is the Francis Bacon Society, which is in the beautiful area of London, which is known as Canonbury. It's also the place where the Arsenal football team is, and it's very close to
used to be
famous Finsbury Park. Oh, is it not there anymore?
No.
Times have moved on. So, Dave Patrick, I found it, by the way. The Beach Boys.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to play the show out with some good vibrations from the Beach Boys. Dave Patrick, thank you from the audience, on behalf of the audience of Ever Beyond, and anybody else who's listening. Thank you very much, and good night.
Yeah, thank you, JP.
Beyond.